Welcome to Health Styles. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. The events that unfolded at the Sandy Hook School, the killings that took place, certainly jarred all of us, it saddened all of us, and many of us were glued to our radios or televisions to find out what happened. And in the early period of time after the killings were made known, there are some concerns about how the media might have covered this event. And these concerns are well-founded because what we see and what we hear affects how we cope as individuals and families and communities with such devastating news. Here to talk to us about how the media did and its impact, potential impact on us, is Steve Gorelick, who is a professor at Hunter College, City University of New York, and on the board of advisors for Columbia University's DART Center on Journalism and Trauma. Steve Gorelick was one member of an expert team who was invited to Norway in the aftermath of the 2011 Utøya mass shooting that led to 77 fatalities. He was there assisting in the study of that incident. So I want to thank you, Steve, very much for joining us today to talk about this important event.
It's good to be here.
So, Steve, you had some observations about how the media covered this event, and I just want to share that I learned of it as I was driving in my car and I turned the radio on, and I started to weep, and certainly could not change the channel, and later I was glued to the television, but then I found myself 2 days later feeling like I don't want to see more media coverage of this at this point. I need to turn it off. What's your sense about how the media covered this event? Let's start with there.
Well, the first thing I'd want to say is that both the media that produces the content they do and the audience that seems to want it, I don't really ascribe sort of venal intentions on either side. Reporters are caught in a professional environment where, in a period of time right before the facts are fully known about an incident like that, they are encouraged to sort of produce as much information as they can, including a lot of speculation, which they then will sort of label as admittedly not confirmed yet. And an audience is, of which you and I were and are both members, are also demonstrating another fully human desire, and that's the desperate need to understand what happened and why. So a lot of the scurrying about that leads to some of the problems in reporting early on happens because we're human beings who have a very hard time living for even a short period of time, with incomplete information, especially about a terrible act, and so we often latch on to all sorts of things. When an incident, by the way, goes on for a while, and we still don't know what really happened, and then we really have the risk of all sorts of urban legends and other distortions occurring. But we're all just trying to make sense and make sense as quickly as we can.
So give us an example of how the immediate media coverage maybe provided a disservice because of some of the speculation that was going on.
Well, I think that for at least an hour and a half, and I didn't keep detailed notes as I watched this, I must confess to you, Diana, that I was so disturbed that I was a little undone myself. But during the first hour and a half, there were a whole series of conjectures about facts about the case, which, again, no one reported them saying that they had confirmed them, although those mistakes have happened in many mass shooting incidents. They were all reported as simply rumors that about the fact that of who the actual perpetrator was, a confusion over the brother, confusion, the issue of whether or not the perpetrator's mother was a teacher at the school or not, or a teacher at all, whether there were one or two shooters. Again, all very natural things for people to want to know, and they were reported as sort of, unconfirmed. But I really want to ask, what is the purpose and what is the potential danger of reporting all sorts of things, even with the sort of tip of the hat to responsibility of saying, well, we haven't yet confirmed this? I think that concerns me a lot.
Why does it concern you?
It concerns me because the earliest parts of from what some of us think we've started to learn about these incidents, the first hour or two, especially if it's an ongoing incident, a lot of us are all of us are extremely vulnerable, extremely raw, extremely hungry to know, sort of get a handle or make sense of what's happened. And we are in a uniquely, as skeptical as we like to think we are, we're in a uniquely vulnerable place to latch on to the earliest kinds of rumors and explanations that come out. And what concerns me especially about the fact that people do latch on to these things is that we have to remember all of this sort of these early speculations are now taking place as much last week as ever before in a social media environment that is so speedy and so real time that when a reporter, an on-air reporter, says, such and such, we heard that the following weapons were in the school, but we haven't confirmed that yet. For good or bad, and I think there's a lot of good and an awful lot of bad, the social media environment now would have any such unconfirmed thing is immediately is put out in the public sphere immediately, often then without the caution of it not having been confirmed. So in a sense, social media has given us access, Twitter, Facebook, and so on, to all sorts of resources and places we can go to get actual good information about incidents. It is as much and can as much be a source of real sort of misinformation. And it's interesting that misinformation that the public may or may not remember or may or may not forget is what I'm. So I'm especially concerned of the confluence of coming together of a lot of rumors, a lot of unconfirmed things, communities that are traumatized and desperate to know exactly what happened, and a social media that will spread things like wildfire.
So, Steve Gorlick, I was so taken by the images, the early images that came out. Certainly the children hand to shoulder, running out of the school, fast walking out of the school with the teachers, but everybody clearly crying, distressed. And concerns about, I was also concerned about some of the early interviews with a couple of the children who got out of the school. Can you talk a little bit about what is the impact of those images on us and on those children and the teachers?
Diana, I've been thinking about this for three decades now. This has been an issue that is something I care about, something I know that Bruce Shapiro and all the other staff at Columbia's Dart Center on Journalism and Trauma are concerned about. It's one of the reasons I'm involved with them. I saw one such interview, and it's the only one I can speak to. And I always have to say that none of us have any idea what behind-the-scenes arrangements were made, what discussions were made, who agreed to do what or when. I could simply throw out that it was an attack interview, if you will, but I don't know the details. But what I do know is this. Even if a parent was with the child and the parent supposedly consented, I want to put out the possibility that certainly a parent has a right to consent, but I would question how well any of us are able to agree to be interviewed in such an immediate aftermath of a trauma. I don't know who agreed to let this particular girl that I saw interviewed be interviewed. She looked fairly composed, but what I realized is that later on, when they announced the extent of what had happened, which came like a real stunner, it very well might be that she was, that her outward composure, that she had been, that she was just shocked into silence. What I can tell you is this, though, this, and that's all guessing a little bit. Mm-hmm. But what isn't guessing is that the reporter didn't know what the child had just seen. The reporter did not know who interviewed the child, without whoever's permission they had, what the child had just seen. And now we know that it's at least possible, I don't know this particular child, but it's at least possible that that child walked past the two crime scenes, the two major crime scenes. And despite the attempts by the wonderful adults leading them out to tell them, you know, don't look or close your eyes and so on, which we know was the case, who knows what this little girl saw? So I'm going to suggest that in cases like this, and I'm really would be open for you know, for vigorous discussion, because I'm a First Amendment person first, most of all. I'm not sure there's ever a place for an interview like that, when you can't know with confidence whether or not you are interviewing someone who you could unintentionally injure or traumatize, given that you don't know what they just experienced.
Say a little bit more about that. How would talking with this child traumatize her? She's already been traumatized. How would asking her about her trauma further traumatize her? And in fact, some people know about critical incident debriefing, where after trauma, people are encouraged to talk about what they experienced as a way of healing, although this is controversial. Talk
yes.
to us about this.
Well, it's interesting, Danny, that you raised this whole debriefing thing. I have the research team that was with us in Norway, and the colleagues that I do interdisciplinary research include psychiatrists who are very much have engaged in writing and discussing about the whole debriefing thing. Again, I can't claim to be an expert at this, but I'll step out on a limb and say that let's assume that some form of debriefing is called for and helpful. I don't know that to be the case. It certainly is not the place of an intelligent, even compassionate reporter to engage in a task with someone without having even the most basic skills and training in how to do a post-incident debriefing. And when someone's just walking out the door of a school, I don't think you could even call that a debriefing. I guess, in sum, I will never know in a given case precisely how a quick sort of attack interview of a victim might or might not traumatize her. But I would suggest that there's enough uncertainty about who you're talking to, what they've been through, and all sorts of factors, that you simply responsibly should opt out of doing those kinds of things. Child walks out, has a microphone. Might it in some cases not be so damaging? I don't know. But I say the uncertainty should lead us to be extremely cautious.
We're talking with Steve Gorelick, who is a professor at Hunter College, City University of New York, and on the board of advisors at Columbia University's DART Center on Journalism and Trauma. And Steve, I want to ask you about, you refer to this interview as an attack interview. Why do you use that phrase?
You got me there. You got me there because I guess in the aftermath of an event like this, you know, you struggle to maintain a stance where you're trying to understand it through the eyes of everyone and to view it empathetically. And yet, I suppose you did hear a little bit of my unintentional anger slip through. But like as I said before, I don't know the context of how this young child agreed to do this. But I suppose I just have a visceral, this case has brought out a lot of visceral stuff in me, and I have a visceral problem with a reporter interviewing anyone without at least some admittedly quick consideration of the context in which they're doing the interview and the possibility of any sort of psychological damage or danger. Not saying that that is inevitable, but at least a quick consideration of it. And when I see when I saw many years ago reporters run in to the airport at Kennedy and I'll never forget it when I saw them run into the midst of a group of parents who were whose children had been in the Lockerbie incident, and begin sort of it looked like attacking to me, Diana. That was a formative experience for me, and I just viscerally will probably never refer to it as I should.
and it probably raises the issue of the tensions between journalism's mission, if you will, to get information for the public versus the impact of that effort on the people being interviewed. So whose interests should the journalist have at heart? Should they have the person that they're, and does it extend to adults? So if in fact that interview could have done more damage to that child by recalling too quickly what that child had seen and experienced, and reliving that episode too quickly, is that the journalist's responsibility to be mindful of that?
You know, I actually think, and this I'm not used to being optimistic about things, but I think that, and I've seen examples of responsible journalists who absolutely can be mindful of the interests of the interview subjects that they're approaching and simultaneously be serving what is the legitimate, important public right to know. What I think happens is, right as they begin to unfold, that a lot of the sort of putting out of rumors and then claiming and then saying that they're not been confirmed. I'm not sure that that's responsible reporting that actually is informing the public. The most responsible reporting that provides the public with the most authoritative information might at some point as these events begin be, heaven forbid, we don't know. And what concerns me, what concerns me is that there seems to be an understandable but problematic sort of reluctance for anyone ever to say, I don't know. We don't know. I just kept hearing, here's what might have happened. Here's what may have happened. Here's what somebody said may have happened. And again, I just got tired this last week of hearing then the reporters just add that bit of it not having been confirmed. I don't buy that anymore. You know, that's not responsible reporting. And I think you can be mindful, and I think that the work that Bruce Shapiro and the people up at the DART Center do, trains reporters how to do this, can meet every public demand to get basic facts and be mindful of the needs of interview subjects. But sometimes being a responsible reporter involves saying the unthinkable, we don't know yet.
So there also, early on, were interviews with a variety of spiritual and moral leaders, mm-hmm. around, you know, how to interpret the situation and what to say to people.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about those kinds of interviews?
Oh, I have a lot of mixed feelings about them. I will say, just for starters, that there's no question that, and last night's memorial service, last Sunday's memorial service, with the president speaking, shows that there is a place for people of some moral or ethical authority to speak and to comfort. I have a problem, again, with the people who are drawing ethical lessons so quickly, and in cases often I saw in which they didn't know all of the facts from which to draw a lesson. I mean, there are a number of, as the facts get clearer and clearer, there are a number of sort of issues, not policy questions, but philosophical and moral and ethical questions that are legitimate to ask, about all sorts of things, about parenting, about treatment of the mentally ill, all sorts of things. But I heard some pretty quick preaching, which I just am more comfortable, as an audience member at least, I'm ready to be given my moral leadership, and I hunger for it. But I wouldn't mind if the people that do it were fully informed about what in fact had happened. I mean, there were people who were talking or making sort of prescriptions about society. These are people that some sociologists call moral entrepreneurs. They were making some prescriptions when the entire public still thought it was only three people injured in a hospital. That was one of the most traumatic things about this incident for me personally. I'm still having aftershocks that all of the coverage, basically, and I think it was probably purposeful on the part of law enforcement until all the notifications could be made, but all the coverage, none of the coverage I saw, and I kept flipping channels, gave away until that last moment when they finally made the announcement that it was not only not just three people injured, but that it was a catastrophe of horrible proportions. So
Steve, we're almost out of time. Could you give our listeners sort of a summary of what you think we need to be mindful of in future media coverage and in how we interpret media coverage of these kinds of traumatic events?
Yes, I would always urge that we all take a very empathetic stance as we judge the actions of any and all parties who are either directly or indirectly involved with these incidents. If I could have one wish, it would be that the sort of rush to need to know, the rush to latch on to unconfirmed facts, the rush to judge people as having not done enough or having done too much, or all the kinds of things that we as human beings desperate to protect our children are want to do. I wish we could just vow to, as we look back at these incidents and as we're living through them, to look at people and empathize that they are fellow human beings who are struggling in the ultimate sort of struggle, the ultimate human struggle, to make sense right after something happens of an unimaginable tragedy. And it's just too easy to be critical and to say that he should have done that, somebody should have done, why didn't we see this, why didn't we see that? You know, those aren't unfair questions, they're natural. But I wish that all of us would sort of judge these incidents with more sort of humility and awareness of the fragility of who we are as human beings struggling to make sense.
And it is, let me just acknowledge, it is difficult because we all want to try to make meaning, have understanding of how something like this could happen. And it leaves us all feeling so vulnerable. And certainly we would hope that the media would not play into that, but would, if anything, help to support finding meaning in responsible ways. So
I have to say, Diana, that the aftermath, by the way,
yeah,
in the days after, some of the very organs and outlets that were jumping to all sorts of conclusions produced all sorts of very responsible reporting and media content. I'm really most concerned about the beginning and when things start up. But
thank you so much, Steve Gorelick. I appreciate your coming on to Health Style. Steve Gorelick is a professor at Hunter College, City University of New York, and on the board of advisors of the Columbia University's DART Center on Journalism and Trauma. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you, Diana.
You've been listening to Health Styles. Health Styles is produced by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College. You can follow us on our blog, HealthCetera, at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. That's centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. I'm Diana Mason, producer of this Health Styles program, one of the producers of this program. Thank you for tuning in.